Hello and welcome to Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255. This week, improving air traffic control, the latest electric car developments, digital SSB receivers, something about ball lightning, and Radio 4 on long wave, a British institution, but how much longer? And of course your letters, so stay tuned, it's Sparks.
Making the most of Europe's airspace, Michael Don Reports on the developments in air traffic control in the Financial Times. Considerable efforts are being made throughout the United Kingdom and Western Europe to improve the overall air traffic control system to enable the air transport industry to cope with the anticipated long-term growth in traffic. Airports and air traffic control, ATC, are heavily dependent upon each other. The best airport terminal in the world cannot function without adequate air traffic control, while the traffic control system must be capable of handling everything that all the air terminals in a given area hand over to it. If either element is in any way inadequate, the air transport system as a whole seizes up. Some time ago, the European Civil Aviation Conference, ECAC, representing the civil aviation interests of more than 20 countries in Western Europe, drew up a strategy for the improvement of air traffic control in Europe, designed to meet an expected growth in traffic from 4 million flights through the central ECAC area in 1990 to between 5 million and 7 million by the year 2000, or growth of between 7 and 9% a year. Although the recession and the Gulf crisis combined have created a hiatus in the situation over recent months, this is now passing and the original growth rates seem likely to be resumed soon. The need for improvements in air traffic control remains paramount. ECAC ministers decided in October 88 that air traffic flow management, the efficient handling of Europe's multitude of intersecting streams of aircraft, should be progressively centralised into a single control unit, which is expected to be fully operational by about 1993. This is a vital step forward in making the best use of available airspace capacity in what is one of the world's most complex and active air traffic regions. In addition to improving flow management, however, much work is being done to expand the capacity of the overall air traffic control system, fitting ever more aircraft into the available three-dimensional airspace with absolute safety. Investment in equipment has been stepped up and is now running at a total ECAC level of more than 700 million ECUs a year. New communications and data links have been installed, new control sectors added, crisis management cells established, and staff recruitment and training increased. The full benefit of these measures is only now beginning to be felt, as many of them require several years to take complete effect. Eurocontrol, the existing central organisation for air traffic control in Europe, is playing a key role in all this, and its importance in the future organisation of air traffic in Europe is assured. It has been selected by ECAC as the vehicle for creating the new centralised air traffic control system for much of Western Europe, capable of expansion to include other countries later on. By the year 2004, it is intended that Europe will have the most modern ATC system in the world, able to cope with the complex and expanding flows of air traffic through more than 20 countries, well into the 21st century. One element of great significance in the United Kingdom has been the development of a new control system called the Central Control Function, CCF, based on a Tunnels in the Sky concept of one-way aircraft arrival and departure routes for each of the airports in the southeast of England. The CCF, based on a system already used in the busy New York and other United States terminal control areas, involves bringing into service modern radar displays and uses improved technology to present information to the controllers. It is designed to streamline the controller's task and lead to an increase of more than 30% in the airspace capacity over southeast England when it becomes fully operational in December 1995. Already, the first phase of the CCF has been inaugurated, moving the controllers who manage flights arriving at or departing from the London terminal area into a new operations room at the London Air Traffic Control Centre at West Drayton near Heathrow Airport. In a later phase, to be completed by 1993, the approach radar control functions at Heathrow, Gatwick and Stansted airports will be transferred to the new operations room. When fully operational, by the mid-1990s, CCF will benefit all air travellers using British airspace, not only those using the London airspace, because a high proportion of all flights, both domestic and international, fly over the southeast of England, and the CCF will smooth those traffic flows. The Civil Aviation Authority is already considering the extension of CCF-type systems to the north of England and the Scottish Lowlands to meet the special needs of those areas and their predicted traffic growth. Elsewhere in the United Kingdom, a £3 million ATC improvement programme has been inaugurated at Birmingham International Airport, where a second £60 million terminal has become operational this summer, raising the airport's capacity to more than 6 million passengers a year. Also part of the Civil Aviation Authority's expansion programme is the construction of an en-route air traffic control centre near Fareham in Hampshire. Due to become operational in 1995, this centre, with about 800 staff, will manage all en-route flights over England and Wales, complementing the CCF operations at the London Air Traffic Control Centre. One development to which increasing attention is now being paid is the use of satellite communications for aircraft, under a system developed by the International Maritime Satellite Organisation, Inmarsat. While much emphasis has been placed upon the use of SATCOMs for provision of in-flight telephones and fax machines for the use of passengers in aircraft cabins, such uses pale into insignificance compared with the advantages that SATCOMs can bring to air traffic services. Mr. Olaf Lundberg, Director General of Inmarsat, said in Paris earlier this summer that those responsible for aeronautical safety were now convinced that satellites were the real key to the future development of effective air traffic services. The combined technologies of mobile communication satellites and global navigation satellite systems provided the raw materials with which to build air traffic control services systems for the next century. This coming September, at a big air navigation conference sponsored by the International Civil Aviation Organisation, the FANS Committee, Future Air Navigation Systems, will be discussing with ICAO member states an overall plan for the introduction of satellite-based communications, navigation and surveillance systems to become available worldwide before the end of the century. The following decade is expected to see a gradual phasing out of ground-based systems, with the aim of replacing them completely by the year 2010. That piece about Europe's air traffic control developments from the Financial Times. And hello to my friends at London Air Traffic Control Centre. Last time I visited the place, they had an AR-88, I believe it was, some ancient valve communications receiver, in one part of their technical area, and this was used for monitoring the operation of aeronautical omnidirectional navigation beacons. These are the things which operate all the way from the long wave broadcast band, through most of them being in the 300 kHz region, and one or two still in this country operating in the bottom end of the MF broadcast band. Most of these things give a two or three letter Morse code identification, which is an abbreviation of the airport or navigation point which they are marking.
Tumbling Freight train crashing headlong into the heartland like a cannon in the rain. With the beating of the sleepers and the burning of the coal, counting the towns flashing by.
Radiofax has recently written a letter to a minister at the Department of Trade and Industry. You may have heard him recently in an interview on BBC Radio in which he said,
"We want to see full use made of the radio spectrum in the United Kingdom."
The DTI is responsible for allocating frequency in this country. And John Redwood is the man to write to. "Dear Mr. Redwood, I'm writing following your recent radio interview in which you stated you were keen to see full use of the radio spectrum. We operate Radiofax, a speech-based radio station, providing a service of technical, science and media news and information on shortwave, and have been seeking a transmitting license in this country for several years. Apart from being a highly valued service for the considerable number of blind shortwave enthusiasts, we now have letters from several thousand listeners supporting licensing for this kind of innovative station as a good use for a few kilohertz of the spectrum. As years have passed, the question has changed from whether such things will be licensable at all to when it will happen here. At the present rate of progress, it seems likely that licenses will be available in former Eastern Bloc states before this country. We are keen that Britain should not drag its feet and repeat the mistakes of citizens' band licensing. Of course, your department could regard our service as similar to those news and information services in the utility bands for groups such as mariners and aviators and provide licensing directly. Can I look to your support, in addition to the letters we have had from Lord Thompson, Chairman of the IBA, the Radio Authority, and Members of Parliament, who welcome the project and wish the idea luck, in encouraging the Home Office to change the present policy of restricting shortwave to the BBC, and find time to regularise and experiment in this area? Yours sincerely, Trevor Brooke." Just a quick look at the letter to Lord Thompson, Chairman of the IBA. And the reply we got back in 1988 included, unfortunately we cannot help under present legislation. He then refers to the lack of interest in HF at the Home Office and ends his letter, I'm sorry we cannot help, but wish you luck with your exciting project. The more recent letter from the Radio Authority says much the same sort of thing. Don't forget, if you would write to your MP, we would be very grateful. Write suggesting licensing shortwave services. And if you have any other letters from the government, please send a copy of the reply you received to us. Of course, if we had a license and transmitters in England, we could provide a far better service, better signals and better programmes. Any letters you'd like to write to us are very welcome. It's Radio Fax 6205 and 12255. Sparks is the weekly programme of technical news and features, and it's on every Monday and Tuesday. Our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.
advertisers, pirates, and the pan-European dimension. Now radio consultant editor Howard Rose sifts the subsoil of the radio broadcast industry. I believe that a person who faces a most difficult task is Gary Meal, who has left KISS FM in London to join the Radio Cheltenham group and their satellite radio station Quality Europe FM. Gary, from selling a fairly straightforward standalone FMer in Britain's busiest radio market and down the road from the majority of advertising agencies, is setting out on what is really a most uncharted road paved with a great deal of expectation. When anybody talks of pan-European advertising, I, and several others close to me, have to chuckle. These chuckles are, to be honest, loud. They come after the experience gained from involvement over the years with Radio Caroline, and they go way back to the summer of 1967. For it was then that the myth of a potential pan-European advertising revenue for radio was first promoted as a possible means to keep Radio Caroline alive financially. You may recall that summer when the Labour government of the day passed legislation to prevent any Briton from advertising on an offshore station. Most stations simply decided to throw in the towel. But, as with any situation created to make their operation difficult, Caroline found a way around. They moved the advertising sales office over to Amsterdam, in the hope of attracting international advertising. At the time, we all imagined it would be the real answer. International advertising on an international station. I agree that this was prior to Britain's joining the European community. But even so, it soon became apparent that there was little chance of getting the Dutch Coca-Cola company to pay for commercials aimed at Britain. The argument was simply that the British bottlers should pay for their airtime, the Belgians for theirs, and so on. Pan-European advertising was as much in its infancy as it would appear to be today. It was a handy line for the offshore radio station to use to explain away how it was receiving finance. It was doubtful whether the authorities in the UK would bother to check with companies located in such places as Spain, Canada, Switzerland, or wherever, as long as the station continued to claim it was being supported by international advertising. The truth is, most deals were concluded in offices in London, and the companies concerned were only interested in paying for reaching the UK audience. Similarly, deals struck between, say, Dutch companies and such stations were intended to generate response from listeners in the Netherlands. That is not to say that there couldn't be a chance for it being created, and that's where I wish Gary Meal the best of luck. He's not only going to be selling the idea of satellite radio, Euro-wide, but also airtime that his company wants to see sold Euro-wide. Somehow, I have a hunch that of the early commercials one might hear on Quality Europe FM, the majority will be placed by UK companies after the UK audience. And there's nothing wrong in that. Money is money, after all. Comment there by Howard Rose in Now Radio. And Quality Europe FM transmits on Sky Movies on a subcarrier of 7.38 MHz.
Yeah. If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck, and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England. 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England. 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Sparks from Radio Fax, presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. Flashes of insight into ball lightning. From Electronics World and Wireless World. One of the most mysterious of all natural phenomena is ball lightning. Over the years, thousands of people have reported seeing football-sized glowing objects floating through the air and then apparently disappearing. Reports of ball lightning go back hundreds of years and have attracted a great deal of scientific curiosity. Sometimes the balls appear as benign objects that just drift through walls or else explode violently. Sometimes they are greenish, blue, white, or even orange in colour. Trying to investigate ball lightning scientifically is difficult because it does not occur regularly or to order. But a search through the literature usually shows that ball lightning occurs during electrical storms, as with conventional lightning, has very little weight, being able to float, and may not always be hot, able to pass through some materials without causing damage, and has frequently been seen moving against the direction of the wind. These observations have led to a number of theories, mostly involving electrical discharges or the presence of fuel gases such as methane in the atmosphere. One of the most interesting ideas, proposed as long ago as 1955 by the Nobel Prize-winning Soviet physicist Peter Kapitsa, proposed that ball lightning might form at the antinodes of interference phenomena among naturally generated radio waves. But until recently, it has been impossible to carry out the definitive experiment and recreate ball lightning in the laboratory. Now, 2 Japanese physicists have described a series of experiments culminating in the creation of artificial ball lightning in a natural atmosphere. What is more, the artificial lightning seems to show many of the properties of the natural variety. Its ability to pass through a wall intact and to move against the wind, for example. Y.H. Otsuka, working at Waseda University, and H. Froton at the Tokyo Metropolitan College of Aeronautical Engineering describe a series of experiments using a 1.5 kilowatt source of microwave energy at 2.45 gigahertz, in effect a rather big microwave oven. When power was fed into the empty cavity of the device, several different types of plasma fires were observed, most occurring only when the apparatus was switched on, although not always at the expected electrical hotspots. On a few rare occasions, the glowing ball punched a small hole in the aluminium foil that formed one end of the cavity. After emerging through the hole, it continued glowing for a second or two after the microwave power had been switched off. In a final experiment, the Japanese team introduced a copper bar into the cavity. When the microwave energy was turned on, a ball-shaped glow was seen to move along the bar. Interestingly, it moved in the opposite direction of a strong blast of air created in the cavity by a fan. All these observed properties, the ability to pass through walls and the tendency to move against the wind, seem to indicate that what the Japanese scientists have created is similar to natural ball lightning. So it suggests that Peter Capizza was on the right theoretical track 35 years ago. The Japanese are cautious, though, recognizing that high-powered microwave radiation does not exist widely in nature, thankfully. But they do believe it can occur momentarily, where, as in a thunderstorm, there is a rapid variation in atmospheric electricity. Such momentary bursts of energy could well be enough to create a lightning ball, which, as the experiments have shown, can persist for several seconds after the energy source has been removed. Precisely why that happens is still a mystery, although the chances of it being solved are vastly greater now that ball lightning can be created in the lab, more or less to order. That was from Electronics World and Wireless World.
This morning, smile with the rising sun. Three little birds pitch by my doorstep, singing sweet songs of melodies pure and true, saying,
this is my message to you. Woo-hoo.
Singing, don't worry about a thing.
Here's a letter from David Gowan from Llanfairian, Aberystwyth in Dyfed. He writes, "It was wonderful to hear music from the 1970s, my favourite decade, I think. Possibly since no other station caters for gays, you could have a gay club music hour, well publicised in the gay press internationally. Please play some gay dance music for all gays, lesbians, transvestites, hermaphrodites, and of course not forgetting heterosexuals that are listening. Let this letter be a plea from 10% of the world population that love to dance boogie. Remember that gays are also members of families and are part of society. I wonder why so many like high-energy music. Well, who cares? Just play it. Thanks, David Gowan. We think there might be a gay radio station in Germany, incidentally.
Searching and seeking, never sleeping. I've got to find me a man. I want no disguises, just surprises. Someone who I'll understand. I don't need a guy who'll spend only one night, then tell me he's got no more time. I'm looking.
Together now. Stay tuned to the occasional bit of high energy and techno on Sparks, and I'll have to see if I can get round to an hour of it sometime. So, something from Trevor now.
Hurdles in the road to a smog-free destination. John Griffiths examines the progress of the electric car in the Financial Times. General Motors has a public commitment to build the world's first mass-produced electric car. It has set up a subsidiary to build it and allocated a plant to build it in. It also has a problem. More accurately, as the weeks pass, it appears to have a growing number of setbacks with its Impact project, which, as touted by former General Motors chairman Roger Smith, when unveiling it 20 months ago, would allow GM to comply with the Californian Clean Air rules for the late 1990s, and found a new branch of the auto industry. GM has denied reports that the Impact project is on temporary hold, insisting that it is progressing. but some of the early momentum appears to have been lost. A few months ago, GM formally set itself the target of having the car on sale by 1994. Now, against the background of a cold financial climate, talk is of the production version of the Impact going on sale in the mid-1990s. To some extent, Smith painted GM into a corner with Impact. The original idea was to demonstrate that an electric vehicle did not have to be slow and barely traffic compatible. Having achieved that, the sight of Impact whizzing like a sports car at 100 miles an hour around test tracks caused something of a sensation. The intention was to await batteries capable of greater range and longer life than lead-acid types before putting a car based on the Impact into production. Such was the media enthusiasm for the vehicle, however, that GM opted for a production program based on current battery technology. Its adequacy looks increasingly suspect. To achieve Impact's much-quoted 120-mile range requires the driver to steer well clear of using its fast acceleration, stand still to 60 miles an hour in around 8 seconds, or top speed. That range is also achievable only on the basis of a full 8-hour recharge, not least the heavy 870-pound and 900-pounds sterling battery packs, comprising 32 10-volt units connected in series, do not yet appear to have met the project target of providing enough deep discharge cycles to cover 25,000 miles before replacement. GM originally wanted the battery pack to have a life of 40,000 miles before committing to production. But there is time yet for the skeptics to be confounded. Several factors make it unlikely that the Impact will suffer the same fate as previous electric vehicle projects. For a start, there is the legislative incentive provided by California. In 1998, 2% of all cars, vans and light trucks sold must be zero-emission vehicles, in other words, electric. That figure will rise to 10% in 2003. So far, GM has given no indication of a likely price for a car based on Impact. In Europe, as the absolute price of petrol and diesel rises, so the expected higher purchase cost of electric cars could be increasingly offset by cheaper operating costs. The US industry is also making its first concerted, large-scale effort to develop new generations of batteries, intended to put the viability of electric vehicles beyond doubt. In January, GM, Ford and Chrysler, with federal government collaboration, created the US Advanced Battery Consortium, committed to spending $1.2 billion over the next 10 years to develop super batteries with sodium sulfur and nickel iron units among the front runners. Even batteries like these, with up to four times the energy density of lead acid batteries, will not turn an electric vehicle into a true rival of the petrol car. But they should be able to provide enough range to allay most potential buyers' fears of flattened batteries on an urban Los Angeles freeway. Not least, Impact is a purpose-built electric vehicle, whereas most would-be rivals are adaptations of conventional cars, like Peugeot's 205 electric hatchback prototype. The car demonstrates that by appropriate design, good aerodynamics, the use of lightweight materials, ultra-low rolling resistance tyres, and the use of advanced electric motor technology, an electric vehicle can have similar on-road performance and agile handling characteristics of a conventional car. Impact makes extensive use of aluminium for wheels, braking systems, and other key components within a lightweight plastic composite body. Its operating range is made possible in part by regenerative braking, in which the twin induction motors driving the front wheels feed electrical energy back into the battery pack. GM is far from alone in its efforts to produce a viable electric vehicle. Chrysler, Ford, indeed every sizable manufacturer, including the Japanese, has projects underway, not wishing to be excluded from the lucrative Californian market. Impact is merely the best known. That by John Griffiths in the Financial Times.
From Electronic Design, exploit digital advantages in an SSB receiver. Improvements in digital conversion technology help radio designers take advantage of digital architectures. Written by Richard Groschong and Stephen Ruskak. The first step in digital receiver design is to determine the radio's front-end specifications. The process is somewhat similar to that in a conventional analog design, but it must account for the characteristics of the digital IF processor used by the radio. After the front end is completed, the designer can proceed to the IF processor, taking advantage of highly integrated devices to simplify the design. The design example here is a 2 to 30 meg SSB receiver, employing undersampling techniques. A 16 kHz front-end bandwidth was chosen to accommodate up to four 3 kHz independent sideband channels. The bandwidth also allows the digital signal processor to perform fine-tuning over at least a 1 kHz range in 1 Hz steps, simplifying the variable injection synthesizer. The first IF is 100 MHz, which is high enough to ensure that the broadband input filter suppresses the IF and image response by 80 dB, but low enough to allow a low-cost crystal filter to be used as the first IF narrowband filter. The first IF amplifier makes up for losses in the first IF mixer and filter, and maintains a front-end noise figure of 15 decibels. After amplification, the signal is mixed with a fixed oscillator signal of 99.544 MHz. The result is a second IF of 456 kHz, which is high enough to allow the second mixer image response at 99.088 MHz to be attenuated by 80 dB in the first IF filter, but low enough to be sampled by the analog-to-digital converter IC. If the ADC's sample and hold bandwidth is greater than 456 kHz, as is the case with the AD779, the receiver can undersample the second IF signal effectively at a sample rate of 96 kHz. Any phase noise present on the clock will be impressed on the signal being sampled, effectively corrupting it. If isolation or buffering is inadequate, the spurious noise picked up by the sample clock can be disastrous. The receiver's minimum weak signal gain must be high enough so that the weakest desired usable signal plus the receiver noise is greater than at least one ADC quantizing level. If not, the signal won't be recovered. The best way to ensure a large enough signal is to provide sufficient noise at the ADC input to dither across a quantizing level. Another consideration is the antenna overload level, which is the antenna signal level at which an undesired received signal can pass attenuated through the 16 kHz bandwidth front end through to the ADC and saturate it. Because this undesired signal would be outside the 3 kHz information bandwidth, it would not affect the normal AGC setting. As a result, the receiver must maintain some headroom to accommodate signal level peaks. Only desired in-band signals should be present after the first narrowband filtering in the digital signal processor. Consequently, 20 dB of headroom is sufficient at the DSP output. At the ADC input, however, large out-of-band undesired signals may be present. Consequently, at least 40 dB of headroom is required. The next step in the design is the digital IF processor architecture, which will depend on the desired level of functionality and the choice of hardware. In a typical implementation of a digital SSB processor, the digitized IF signal is first processed by the IF translator. The translator shifts the SSB channel's center frequency to DC, or zero frequency, and at the same time converts the real IF signal to a complex baseband signal, with real and imaginary components. The next step is to implement the SSB filter, AGC, and demodulator in the digital signal processor chip. But the system's sample rate must be reduced as much as possible before the DSP can perform these computationally intensive algorithms. For example, if the DSP's instruction rate is 12 MHz and the sample rate remains at 96 kHz, only 125 instruction cycles will be available to run the algorithms on each point. Therefore, the receiver decimates the sample rate by a factor of 10. The resulting 9600 Hz rate is enough to support the typical 3 kHz SSB bandwidth. It also enables 1250 instruction cycles between the decimated samples, enough to perform the required algorithms. Before the sample rate can be reduced, the input signal must be filtered to attenuate out-of-band signals. After decimation, the signal passes through a high-performance receiver IF filter. This SSB filter is an FIR, or finite impulse response device. If necessary, the SSB filter's output level is adjusted by the digital portion of the AGC algorithm. The leveled real and imaginary outputs are then applied to the envelope detector and SSB product detector. The envelope detector computes the magnitude of the phasor represented by the complex components. The output envelope is simply the square root of the sum of the squared values. The AGC algorithm uses the envelope to adjust the receiver output level by a combination of analog, or RF, and digital gain control. To prevent saturation by strong out-of-band signals, the algorithm also senses any ADC overload and adjusts the RF and digital gain distributions accordingly. The SSB product detector is a half-complex frequency translator that shifts the SSB carrier to its proper frequency. Just as in the IF translator, the circuit uses a complex oscillator, commonly called a beat frequency oscillator. First, the complex signal values are multiplied by the cosine and sine outputs of the oscillator. Then the products are added to produce the receiver's audio output. The hardware needed to implement the digital IF processor depends on several factors, but nearly all systems will include certain components. The total number of ICs can be minimal, keeping the overall cost low. Modern communications receivers would typically use a high-performance digital signal processor, such as the ADSP2101. The digital IF processor's high integration level is indicative of the future of SSB equipment. As the performance of the ADC improves, it will be placed closer to the receiving antenna in the analog front end. The ultimate goal is to digitize the incoming RF signal directly from the antenna and implement the remaining digital functions in custom ASICs. Written by Richard A. Groschong and Stephen Ruskak, two very clever people writing in electronic design. Sparks 6205 and 12255 on Radio Fax. A letter from Tom Reed in Titherington, Macclesfield. I write to you on 3 points. The first is a question. Is Radio Fax one word? I suspect it is. Well, you're right. Radio Fax. I recall Radiofax printed as a single word in both your 1988 and 1991 information sheets. That's right, but I suspect many people are fooled by your QSL card, if indeed Radiofax is one word. Yes. Secondly, I wish to enter the Sparks competition. More on that at the end of September. I'll see if we get any more entries. If you'd like to enter the competition, the question is, what was the first frequency used by Radiofax? That was in Easter of 1988. I'll give you the address in a bit. Address to Sparks. Finally, from Tom Reed's letter, here is a list of all the pirate logs I have made since I last contributed to Sparks. Very comprehensive list of shortwave, 6205, of course, 6211, Voice of Love, 6219, Midlands Music Radio, 6220, Radio Telstar, 6220, Live Wire Radio, 6225, Britain Radio International, 6230, Jolly Roger Radio, 6240, Radio Merlin International, 6252, Live Wire Radio, 6254, Radio Geronimo, 6275 West and North Kent Radio, 6276 Live Wire Radio, 6280 Ozone Radio International, 6280 Radio North Light, 6282 Live Wire Radio, 6282 Pirate Freaks Broadcasting Service, 6290 Radio Confusion, 6290 Weekend Music Radio, 6290 Radio London via Free Sound Radio, 6293 Radio Stellar International, 6300 Wonderful Free Radio London, 6302 Radio Confusion, 6558 Free Sound Radio. And in the Manchester area, you could listen out on FM for 101 Unity Radio and 104.4 IBC Radio. In Liverpool, he mentions 100 Kiss FM, 101 Choice FM, 104.9 Toxteth Community Radio. And on medium wave in Liverpool, he can hear on 1350 kHz North Coast Radio. And in ERA, on medium wave, this is logged in Prestatyn, 954 North Atlantic Radio and 981 Radio Star County. The various QTHs are due to my profession as a musician. I had a gig in Liverpool recently, and now I'm on summer season in Prestatyn. I wonder what instrument he plays. In a couple of respects, Sparks is the best DX show on the dial. Thanks. Firstly, it's lengthy. Most DX programmes on international outlets are over before they've begun. Even the longest one, Radio Netherlands, is barely 30 minutes, and HCJB is spread out over the religious messages and simple items, how to write reception reports, etc. Also, I never miss any item as I can listen several times if necessary over a 48-hour period, Sunday night to Tuesday night as I see it. I appreciate that it is asking a great deal, but a few more original items by the Sparks team would be nice. Well, I think I agree. In 88, we did interviews, visits to shows and exhibitions, equipment reviews and reports. Well, it's in a matter of time we'll gear ourselves up to doing it. I shouldn't think we'll have much chance to do very much before we have our transmitters in England, because a lot of our time is spent communicating with where our transmitters are located. But I will try and find a few minutes to do some stuff. My portable tape recorder is sitting on my bench in front of me, so I've got no excuse really. Maybe as well as listing listeners' logs of pirate stations, you could also have free radio news and your own views on the pirate scene. This is one type of free radio programming that I feel has been on the decline with the closures of Radio Atlantis Shortwave, Radio East Coast Commercial, Atlanta Radio, etc. Is it a remote possibility that in the future a live program could go out on Radiofax, and maybe even a QSO with other stations on a Saturday night? It's possible, but difficult at the moment. Many thanks for your excellent programmes, and keep up the good works. Regards and 73s, Tom Reed. Thanks, Tom, for that. And if you would like to write to Sparks, the address is Radiofax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG. You'll get a mention on the programme, and if you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. From Electronics Weekly, 3D minus specs. Japan Broadcasting and NTT are both working on development of televisions that provide three-dimensional images without requiring viewers to wear ridiculous spectacles. Although several years away from being a consumer product, the 3D screen is said to include hundreds of miniature double convex lenses built into its surface. Intriguing stuff.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Here's a piece about radio listening in the UK. This comes from the Radio 4 programme, Kaleidoscope.
As a statistician, I'd say it depends what you mean by listening, but the basic fact is that 40 million people do tune in each week.
That's in spite of all the competition from TV, video.
Yes, I think the most positive aspect of the whole report is that in spite of the fact that over the last 10, 15 years, there's been enormous competition from other far more sophisticated home entertainments, radio has still managed to retain its audience.
So much for the good news. But what are the prospects for radio in the 90s, with the Broadcasting Act promising us three new national commercial stations and perhaps hundreds of smaller local ones? That legislation was conceived in the optimistic thrusting 80s. How does it look now?
The fact is that the Broadcasting Act has actually now come on stream at the beginning of the 90s, and we're faced with two major problems as far as we can see. One is that in terms simply of audience reach, radio seems already to be near saturation. As many people are listening to the radio as seem likely ever to do so.
So news stations really have to grab other people's listeners?
Yes. There's very little scope, we feel, for grabbing new listeners. They've either got to grab other people's listeners, or they've got to make sure that those people who do listen, listen for even longer.
You said there were two problems.
The other one is more of an economic problem. The independent radio stations are paid for by commercial advertising revenues, and there's the problem of where is this advertising revenue going to come from?
So is the Broadcasting Act, in retrospect, going to look like a damp squib?
At the moment, unless something fairly revolutionary happens, there is this fear that it might.
So, this independent report bears out media people's concern about a station like Showtime Radio, the first national commercial station. Its audience is most likely to come from competitors like Radio 2, and its advertising revenue will be at the expense, most likely, of independent local radio.
A report there by Tony Jakes on Radio 4's Kaleidoscope.
Everything is wonderful. Being here is heavenly. Every single day she sends. Everything is free. I used to be so careless, as if I couldn't care less. Did I have to make this mess when I was married? Suddenly the heavens rolled, suddenly the rain came down, suddenly was washed away, the Mary that I knew. So when you find somebody who can think of me and celebrate, I made such a big mistake when I was Mary's brain. So if I say
Leave a light.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D, test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen, Tony Prince in 1966, other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s, and you'll hear too memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, P.O. Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, The Legend Lives On.
Cutting a long wavelength short, the BBC fancies Radio 4 as a high-tech, high-fidelity FM station, but the listeners don't. Stephen Games tunes into the argument in the Evening Standard. There was a curious excitement at Broadcasting House when Mikhail Gorbachev was deposed. Soviet hardliners were in charge, and Boris Yeltsin had clambered over a tank and called for strikes. But for the staff at Radio 4, the real interest of the day had been the elbowing of Down Your Way out of its long wave slot by a half-hour news programme. First time it's ever happened, one producer explained feverishly. During the Gulf War, scheduled programmes stayed on Radio 4 long wave while FM was given over to news specials. Today, the opposite happened. Of course, we could have carried the John McCarthy press conference on Longwave last week, but John hadn't written his speech in time, so we dropped it. Great, isn't it? The significance of that rescheduling is that until now, although Radio 4 has gone out on Longwave and FM, FN has been the junior partner. That's why it was always FM which got disrupted when an alternative signal was needed, such as Tuesday and Thursday afternoons when Radio 4 splits to carry Prime Minister's questions. Now FM has been given seniority and Longwave has become the disposable wavelength. For those of us who prefer the muffled, muzzy, womb-like acoustic of Longwave, this change marks what may be the end of civilization as we know it. We like the fact that Radio 4 Longwave can be heard right across Western Europe and that it carries the world service through the night. And we suspect that now Radio 4 has been redefined as an FM station, along with Radios 1, 2 and 3, it won't be long before Radio 4 on Longwave is taken away. We've good reason to think so. In 1988, because of the shortage of frequencies for commercial radio, the Home Office told radio stations to stop broadcasting on more than one wave band. The BBC responded by deciding to make its main four services FM only. That's why 909 metres, I think he should have printed kilohertz there, the old Radio 2 signal is now Radio 5. And why radios 1 and 3 will shortly be losing their medium wave signals on 275 and 285 metres and 247 metres to the private sector. Axing Radio 4 on Longwave is the obvious next step. Remember Arnold Goodman's advice to Jeremy Thorpe that it was a mistake to defend yourself against a charge of stealing an apple by saying, "I didn't steal it. And anyway, I don't like apples." We needn't worry about Longwave being given to the private sector, says the BBC, because Longwave is the UK's emergency channel, and it's as safe as anything in the known world. And anyway, signal quality is better on FM. True or false? The BBC says that the requirement to give up its duplicate frequencies only referred to medium wave, and the DTI confirms that Radio 4 will continue on long wave for the foreseeable future. But the Home Office says that Radio 4 cannot retain long wave indefinitely. Although there is no deadline, it expects the BBC to have developed plans to reuse the 198 kHz frequency by the time its charter comes up for renewal in 1996, something Radio 4 doesn't seem aware of. Perhaps these people should talk to each other. So the fogies seem justified in suggesting that Longwave, the very temple of British values, is under threat. You can be sure that Prince Charles doesn't listen on FM. Its loss is clearly a pinko conspiracy to destabilise the middle classes and finish off Britain's already waning influence abroad by preventing Radio 4 being heard by expatriates holed up on the continent. The wish to FMise the BBC, they feel, isn't just a question of metres and kilohertz, but of cultural survival. Longwave may not have the icy clarity of FM, surely a Japanese invention, and it's no good for stereo, unhealthy German obsession, but it has a quality as comforting and distinct as a pair of worn slippers or an old teddy bear. Abandoning it would be like giving up the empire or foregoing anchovy paste on toast at tea time. But fogies also object to being bombarded with propaganda, some in the style of popular Radio 4 programmes, encouraging them to switch to FM because of its better quality. You can get it on stereo, and the signal's as sharp as buggery, says Carter, a character from Peter Tinniswood's Uncle Mort stories in one of the trailers. These messages have been met by a barrage of calls and letters from listeners, coming down 12-1 against, according to Radio 4's feedback programme. Many have complained of bad reception in specific areas, and Mr. John Cox of Liverpool has told feedback that FM was lousy everywhere, and threatens to take the issue to the Court of Human Rights at Strasbourg. Fogies feel strongly about these things. The BBC defends the quality of its signal and suggests that the fault lies with us, the listeners. Stand your radio on a piece of silver foil if FM acts up in the kitchen, says one BBC engineer. Buy better equipment if you're driving, change your aerial regularly, or get get an RDS radio, the one that automatically retunes to the best available frequency. All as if we had unlimited money. Some fogies think that the argument about sound quality is a diversion, however. What lies behind the BBC's propaganda isn't its interest in better reception, but its need to protect its investment in new technology by maintaining high listening figures at a time when audiences are drifting from national to local stations. The investment is considerable. For years, Longwave has come to us from a modest little transmitter in Worcestershire, Droitwich. Even the name sounds like something from an Ealing comedy, which puts out 500 kilowatts of power, equivalent to 500 electric one-bar fires, for the whole of England and Europe, plus 250 kilowatt transmitters in Scotland. Simple and reliable, like Meccano. FMisation, however, has meant building another 37 main transmitters plus 110 supplementary transmitters. Figures are not available for what that has cost in capital outlay, mast maintenance, servicing and staffing, or what impact it has had on the nation's landscape, when every high spot now has a tower on top of it. But the point is this: unlike Longwave, FM signals don't travel far and are easily interrupted. Adapting FM for national listening is therefore cumbersome and inconvenient. The real aim of the BBC's propaganda is to persuade us otherwise. Mr. R. Meads, a mobile radio engineer from Sheffield, isn't persuaded. He had tried listening to Radio 4 while the Longwave transmitter was down recently. I kept a log, he told feedback, 37 retunings in 40-odd miles, whereas on Longwave, rock solid everywhere, no switching, no flutter, no fade, no problems. Stop these blatant lies about FM's superior quality. But the question of long-wave survival as a carrier of Radio 4 comes down to BBC policy. The BBC says that long-wave is safe, but the fact is that it is being used increasingly to extend the choice of listening. From September, for example, in addition to question time in the afternoon, it will carry the daily service from 10 to 10:30 a.m, while normal programming continues on FM. This is an obvious sign that far from wishing to go on duplicating Radio 4, the BBC is looking for alternative uses. Quite right, cards on the table, I'm no fogey. Longwave is the country's only national channel, and from Limoges to Liverpool, the signal is like granite. As the Gulf coverage showed earlier this year, there's superb news operation which deserves its own outlet. Longwave should become Radio 6, a non-stop news network, the radio equivalent of CNN. The news department wants it, and once they've got used to it, the fogies will come to love it too. They just need a little time. That article, with a large cartoon at the top of it, by Stephen Games in the London Evening Standard.
A good idea, I think. On to a letter from Dave Smith from Llandudrod, Wells, Powys in Wales. I heard Sparks wonder about one report recently that listed Radio Dublin, but I logged it too. I have a feeling that it may have been a contribution from the Northern Ireland radio relay service. Frequencies on my log are occasionally educated guesses. And he sends a long log, many of which I listed earlier in the programme. A lot of duplicates, but thank you very much. Very accurate. Considering you don't have a digital readout. He finishes off, if you know anybody who has a comms receiver with a digital readout going cheap, please put them on to me. Well, if anyone would like to write to Dave with some offers via Sparks, we'll pass them on.